Hello and welcome to the Cardinal News of Virginia, a podcast from Cardinal News. We're a nonprofit, independent newsroom serving Southwest and Southside Virginia at cardinalnews.org. I'm Lisa Rowan. The Cardinal podcast is sponsored by West Piedmont Regional Adult Education, helping to build skills and earn credentials for sustainable employment and self-sufficiency. Contact WPRAE.com. Today, we're joined by Executive Editor Jeff Schwanner. Among the many duties at Cardinal News, Jeff spends much of his time editing many of the most complex and in-depth articles that you see on our website. We are sitting down today to talk about some of Jeff's favorite projects from 2025, and we'll take a look at where our reporting is headed in 2026. Jeff, thanks for being here with us.
Glad to be here.
Let's start by going over a few glossary terms that come up often in our industry, and I think they're sometimes used interchangeably. Tell us about watchdog, accountability, and investigative journalism, and what makes each of those distinct from the others.
Sure. And, you know, they are kind of used interchangeably in, you know, in the vernacular, and sometimes TV news reports that say they're investigative don't really feel investigative. So it's good to just kind of go over them. And it's pretty simple. Watchdog journalism, just think of that watchdog. It is, it's at the edge of its property and it is barking. And the dog is barking because it's seeing something unusual. There's somebody there who shouldn't be there. There's something strange going on. So watchdog journalism is just calling attention to something. This could be, it doesn't necessarily require investigation. It could be something that happens in a meeting. It could be something that shows up in an agenda or in a budget. It could come from a tipster. A good example of watchdog journalism is Sam Varelli's story, her first story about the Noke van fire at Riverdale. And her reporting that the water that feeds the fire suppression systems was cut off. So it's not saying somebody's at fault. It's not saying something illegal was done. It's saying like, hey, there was this fire and the water was cut off. So, first responders had to find a hose that stretched 984 feet or something to get to the nearest fire hydrant so they could begin to fight this fire. So that's watchdog journalism, really in a nutshell. It's calling attention to something. Now, accountability journalism is, again, kind of exactly what it sounds like. It is holding public officials and systems to account, right? So to follow up on Samantha's story, the accountability side of the reporting came in when we were able to look at a bunch of emails that we acquired through the Freedom of Information Act and see that, yes, the water was cut off. Maybe worse is that the city knew that the water was cut off, endangering all of the people who were doing business and all the people who were going there to do business, including, you know, kids at the ballet theater or something. And we also found out, you know, that the reason that the fire department had a 900-foot fire hose is because they knew that they were going to have to go that far to put out the fire. So that brings up all these questions about, did the city do the right thing? Did the fire marshal do the right thing? You know, was the right thing being done? Accountability journalism often relies on stuff that is publicly available, but just not seen too often, right? So that involves just staring at spreadsheets and budgets and agenda packets and doing Freedom of Information Act requests for other documentation that is not as readily available, but that is public. Like every email that your elected and non-elected local government officials, state officials, federal officials send to one another is public document. So you should have a chance to see that. So that's where accountability journalism comes in. Another good example of that, one of my favorite examples this year, is Beth Byer's story on the claim being made by the then Attorney General Jason Meares running for re-election, who was claiming that 53 Virginians had died as a result of people being let out early from the results of this specific bill that his opponent had helped vote into law. And so the question there is, well, is that accurate? And because it just seemed a little specific to me when I first heard it, I was like, okay, so not odd that it's specific, but a reporter will be like, that is so specific, it must mean there's data behind it. So let's go get the data. So thus followed, starting in the summer, a 4-month journey to get the data, and then to realize that no, the claim as it was being made was absolutely incorrect. And worse, the data provided by the Attorney General's office and by the Department of Corrections was so muddled, it took a long time just to figure out what it was actually saying. And when we figured out what it was saying, which was maybe, you know, four people might have been involved in incidents that might have caused deaths. And we're talking about hundreds and thousands of people released under this law. We had to go back to the OAG and the DOC, and we had an hour-long phone call the Friday before the week that this story published, where we just really wanted to get to the bottom of it. So accountability isn't a gotcha story. You know, it's really just getting to the bottom of something that local officials are saying or doing, or that a system is doing, and reporting it accurately. So the huge triumph of accountability journalism in this case was that Cardinals reporting, Beth's hard work, resulted in the Attorney General's own office refuting his claim by explaining the facts. So that's accountability journalism. And then investigative journalism. Oh, and one more example of good accountability journalism is, it was several months ago, right, Lisa, you were involved in this reporting when Senator Mark Warner said that there would be a diminishing number of Northern Virginians applying to Virginia Tech as a result of people being laid off in the federal government in Northern Virginia. And you were able to report just maybe last week that in fact wasn't true, right? So we'll hold anybody's feet to the fire. But like when we hear certain things like that, then we are going to ask questions. And the more specific the claim is, then the more insistent we're going to be that, well, show us the data behind it.
Yeah. Anytime there's a number involved and it's a very specific number that someone in power is citing, like 53 Virginians died because people got out of prison early and then committed these crimes, we were like, like, that's very specific. Like, how do you know? And like, it's that classic journalism question of like, how do you know that? And even though someone in power is telling you something, doesn't mean you can't still check it.
Absolutely. And this should go without saying, but I will say it because I'm the master of saying the things that should go without saying as your editor, is that, you know, in a lot of cases, accountability journalism is an ongoing set of questions. And you're not looking to, like I said, you're not looking to catch somebody in the act. You're just looking to confirm data in many cases, or confirm that certain behaviors are in line with regulations or with laws. So there's a lot of accountability journalism that doesn't turn into stories, because that's part of our job, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. is to do that. So quick recap, we'll get on to investigative. Watchdog, dog is barking. It is calling attention to something. Accountability is through the use of mostly public information and data. We are seeing whether a claim made or whether a claim made by a public official is true, whether a system that is part of our local government is on the level, is spending our money responsibly, for instance. Now, investigative. So the biggest thing about investigative journalism is that it could be watched. It could start with a watchdog story. It could lead to multiple watchdog stories. It could start with an accountability story. But investigative journalism, again, exactly what it sounds like. It's finding out something that most of us had no idea was the fact. And that is what really sets investigative journalism apart. And the thing I love about investigative journalism as an editor is that when a reporter gets onto a story and they get into that investigative mode and they find that thing, then as an editor, I know, well, this is exclusive, you know? And so like, you're not worried in the same way you might be in other cases about the timeliness of it. You can really hone in on how deep do we need to go? How much do we need to explain? How much context do we need to provide? And really tell the story as best you can. But you know that as long as, you know, facts are on your side, accuracy is important. You know that like those stories are absolutely bulletproof. They're absolutely foolproof. And there's nothing better than publishing like a big story knowing that all of the facts are on your side.
It is the best feeling when you publish something and you're like, that is ironclad. I checked those facts myself.
Yes. And I've heard you say that, Lisa, many times. And I'll talk about, you know, one of the findings of our state of surveillance project, which became investigative in nature, is when we just started, you know, doing the stereotypical thing and following the money. We didn't just stop at finding that, you know, the vast majority of police departments and county sheriff's offices in Cardinal country were using this high-tech public surveillance. But we asked that next question, which was, well, how can they afford this? And then we found out that the Virginia State Police has a fund that is supposed to be helping to stop auto theft by paying off tipsters with money, and that millions of dollars over the last several years have gone from that fund to small county sheriff's offices, to medium-sized county sheriff's offices and police departments to buy this tech, largely Flock.
And the tipsters have not really gotten their rewards. Maybe there aren't many tips, but there also aren't many rewards either. So we see all this money going from what was supposed to be for these tipsters to all these surveillance programs that local police departments are getting. And it, you know, it like sends off the little signals in your head of like, what's going on here?
Yes. And you see how a good investigative story can turn into other accountability stories. Like, is it right that the state police are funding a program that enables small police agencies to spy on the public? Isn't that something that the legislators who made this bill into law in the 1990s should know about? Apparently the VSP didn't think that it was such a big deal. that to me, that's a great example of investigative work. I will call one more story out, because it's a different type of investigative work. I've done this sort of stuff myself. And that is the kind of historical narrative investigative piece. And Paper of Record by Grace Mammon, our Danville reporter, was a wonderful example of that. And really great historical narrative investigative work. It does a couple of things. It shows us that things like the past and the problems of the present are not that far away from what the problems of the past were, and B, that the past might have been a very scary place, you know, and maybe not as golden days as we thought it was. And in the case of Danville during the civil rights, you know, movement, what Grace reported on in more depth in Paper of Record was that, you know, while the main daily paper of record was publishing people who were being arrested and charged during the civil rights protests, and writing largely uncorroborated stories of them setting things on fire and attacking police officers and stuff, there was a whole nother paper that the Black population was reading that provided more observational and more accurate versions of these stories. And most people looking back wouldn't think that there was, you know, that wasn't that the golden age of print journalism? Aren't we missing so much from print journalism because it's no longer around? Well, in that case, you had two different versions of what happened over the course of the day. And this was long before our country, you know, hit this kind of media divisiveness between, you know, left-leaning media, right-leaning media, and fake news and all these other things. This was, you know, in a very small, stable, you know, environment where it turned out there were two different ways of reporting the news.
Yeah, that's one of those great examples of a story that tells something that's untold to our audience. And that really is like at the core of what Cardinal News does. And when we think about watchdog and accountability and investigative stories, I like to think of it as like a Venn diagram, a three-part Venn diagram, and the ways they overlap can change, you know, day to day, story to story. But when I talk to a layperson who's not involved in journalism, I usually just say I'm working on an investigation because they sort of know in their mind what that is. And also it sounds sexier than saying, I'm working on a watchdog story. And they're like, what's a watchdog story?
Or even like, I'm doing accountability journalism.
Right. I'm working on an investigation. And they're like, oh, what's it about? And usually I'm like, I can't tell you yet, but just trust me. But tell me a little bit about how you see this reporting fitting into what Cardinal News does. Because I know that in this current age of journalism, there is a pull sort of on publications like ours that have a wide coverage area of covering the day-to-day, what's happening in communities versus taking time on these deeper stories that can take time to find answers and to look into claims. And so how do you see the mix and how do you see these deeper stories fitting into the mission of Cardinal News?
Right. So in Cardinal country, we definitely have had the responsibility to try and create as much civic journalism as we can. And we really put, you know, our sights on that in 2025, publishing agenda-based stories and following up on these hyper-local stories. So people knew before it happened what their local government was going to vote on and discuss and talk about. And just that, it's almost, you know, I don't want to get political about this, but it's almost like a vaccination effect. Like people know before something happens, it's kind of preventative medicine when the public knows what the local government is going to be doing, how it's going to be spending their money or money that's received from the state or from the federal government. But then there are these larger issues that, you know, that need to be looked into. And the stories that I just mentioned are very strong examples of this type of investigative accountability and watchdog work. Some come about because that local journalism has seeded some trust in the community. And then, like, we all know, like, the number of news tips that we've gotten in the last year have gone up from the previous years. And of course, we're getting more reporters in more areas. So there's a certain math that's, you know, that's predictive there. But that is great to see, and it's great to see how many good story ideas we have continued to get from readers. And I think some of that is just being there and writing the civic journalism. The investigative, accountability, watchdog journalism, that does take a lot longer to do. And if you're not going to rely on it coming through tipsters, then you have to develop that watchdog mindset to be on the lookout for anything, sniff out anything that seems unusual, right? And put time into looking at public documents that might not yield news in this news cycle. And Cardinal has never been the, I'm only going to look at it if it makes me a news story right now type of newsroom. We've always been willing to go deeper. Our stories are, you know, often provide more context and more depth on the same topics that are being written about by other media who have a different set of concerns and a different set of deadlines than we do. But we are really going to put effort in this year to let's identify and create those habits which make it more likely that we're going to see this unusual activity in a budget, or we're going to be checking these emails on a regular basis, or we're going to be looking at nonprofits 990s. And that sort of thing is how we get great investigative journalism. And without saying too much, we do have a couple stories in the works that that will come from one or more of those types of habitual searches. I said earlier, there's a real thrill in being an editor. When these stories start simmering, it's more thrill and less anxiety because I trust the reporters' work at Cardinals so much, having worked with them for a year and change now, and seeing what you guys are all capable of doing. That being said, you know, there are times when you need to bring the lawyers in. There are times when you need to get a person who has not read the story at all up to that point to read it from scratch. And that could be another reporter. It could be one of our great copy editors. And they always will come back and say, like, you know, this paragraph doesn't exactly make sense to me. And it's really easy once you go down an investigative rabbit hole to lose your bearings. And thank goodness for other readers to help come along and do fact checking long before publication.
For sure. Definitely. I asked you when we planned this episode to talk about some of your favorite projects we published in 2025. And you've mentioned a couple. There was the Noak Vance Fire story, the early release murder story. There was State of Surveillance. There was Paper of Record. And we'll provide links to all of these stories in our show notes. And some of them have podcast episodes as well. So be sure to go back in the archives there. But Jeff, I asked you to bring no more than three favorites, which I know is like trying to choose your favorite child. Like, you love them all equally. However, there are things that stick out in your mind over the course of a year of reporting and editing. So is there a particular story that you want to share with us that was published in 2025 by Cardinal that particularly highlights the work we've done in this accountability realm?
So there are a couple more. Obviously, like, I think State of Surveillance was a kind of crowning achievement for Cardinal in 2025, because literally the entire staff was involved in the research that turned into the additional research that especially you did, Lisa, getting that that first, you know, story out. And it's not every day that I get taken to court and sued by by a couple of municipalities simply for filing a Freedom of Information Act request. And we won. Spoiler alert, story's only been out since May, but yes, we won. So like, State of Surveillance is kind of special to me because I got to see what folks were made of and when they were, you know, given a kind of task, which might not be delicious, to like look up data, send out FOIAs, ask questions, call sheriff's offices, that kind of thing. But there are a couple stories that are not, you wouldn't at first blush think they're accountability stories, but there's sense of a good mix of civic journalism and accountability in it. And I think of the data center project that Grace and Tad did. And I remember certain conversations. These are all the stories behind the story type of stuff. But I remember certain conversations where, talking with the two of them about that project, they were like, yeah, these things are like, you know, they're like, you know, lantern flies in Northern Virginia. They're all over the place. And so I remember talking to Grace and being like, the only way to know what Pennsylvania County or some other place that has a data center, the only way to know what that place is going to be like several years from now is to go to one of these places that has had a data center for several years. And Grace is like, all right, I'm going, you know? So she spent a couple of days in Northern Virginia around a couple of data centers, talked to neighbors, found out the types of effects that you wouldn't, you know, think of that really place the local human impact at these massive things. And I remember some of that reporting included the hum and the kind of hum and sound of the data center from hundreds of yards away, and that the construction itself had created some foundational problems for some neighbors, just all of the blasting and stuff like that. So there are all these details that, yeah, you don't think of, and they're one-offs until it's your foundation that's being wrecked because of a bunch of blasting going on to build this massive data center. It's your view that's being ruined. And that you realize that, hey, I'm not getting any free internet out of this. You know, like, there's no real immediate benefit to be the neighbor of a data center. You don't get better Wi-Fi. You don't get better AI. You don't get anything's nothing is different, right? So I do think of that story. Honestly, like, I think the work that Beth did on the story about Jason Miari's claim really goes to the heart of what we do. And it took so dang long because the data was so messy. And we were very patient in going back and back and back. And there could have been many moments along that path where we tried to file a gotcha story. Mm-hmm. But the point wasn't to file that type of story. The point was to get to the bottom of it, right? Because if the claim is right, then that shows that's a different type of accountability story. That shows, like, how did we get to this point where X was happening when we, you know, did not think that would be happening? Why hasn't anybody but Miares noticed this? And then it would have led to the next question: is he is the attorney general? Why isn't he doing something about it? What could he possibly do? What's in his power to do? What's in the power of the legislature to do? So there's all these different accountability stories that could have spun off of that story, depending what the actual data told us, right? But what we got was data that told us that not a lot was happening. And when we went into the field, and Beth did, and talked to a bunch of Commonwealth's attorneys, they would tell us nobody was killed in this, you know, in this person's police incident. Nobody died as a result of this. That type of nuance it's really important to be able to report. It takes time and it takes patience. And in some cases, even when you get all the data you think you're getting, then you might have to do something else, like get out into the field and go talk to the human beings who are involved in those cases and find out exactly why the stuff in this spreadsheet provided by the government doesn't match the court records, for mm-hmm, instance. Mm-hmm. So I was super proud of that work. Again, like one other story that I just think speaks to our team's ability to move quickly is when the court ruling came down that would hold the disenfranchisement of some voters off the voter rolls. And it was like late October or something. And I remember on our morning call telling everybody, we got to go out there like today. We got to find out who is, you know, not on the rolls or who was taken off the rolls. And the only way to do that was to go to all these registrar's offices all over the region. And everybody went out and we found like a dozen people, and a bunch of you guys went out and we ended up finding three or four people like who happened to be home in the middle of the afternoon painting their house or whatever. And we're able to write that story and just show again how some of these things come right down to home level and hit you in that way.
Yeah, that was a 2024 story, actually. And it's still one that we point at to sort of like rev up our morale, to be like, look what we did on short notice and everyone worked together. And it really goes to the collaborative nature of journalism, which sometimes you don't see, because sometimes it's one person's name at the top of a story and you don't realize that, you know, one reporter consulted another about something that they're an expert in. And maybe three editors spent time in meetings working on a story and making sure those facts were ironclad. And,
oh, yeah.
It's a lot more collaborative than a lot of people think, but it is sometimes you're in a silo and sometimes you're in the, I don't know if there's a farm analogy to make, but sometimes you're in the middle of the barnyard with everyone grazing. I don't know.
Out in the compost field? I don't know. I will say that all this leads me, you know, to say that we're putting our foot on the pedal for 2026. And when I was a kid, I used to see this TV commercial all the time for the Boston Museum of Science. And they would say, you know, come to the Boston Museum of Science, where it's fun to find out. And that is what this type of work is all about. It's about finding out more. So if I had to sum what we're going to try and do in the next year at Cardinal News, it would be find out more.
Excellent. And I know you sort of hinted about some stories that are coming out. Do you want to give any other hints as to those, or would you like to keep it a secret surprise because they're still in the works?
Yeah, they're still in the works. But I think we'll see the publication of one of those stories in January. And I wish I could say more.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that can be tough on these kinds of stories is that you don't exactly know how long it's going to take sometimes. And even when you think you know when a story might be done and when it might be published, that can get pushed back because you might find out more information, because you're second guessing something and you want to make sure the date is right, or just because there's a lot of stories on the calendar and only so many sets of eyeballs to edit them. So there's a lot of factors at play there, too, which make it a little hard to predict what's happening when.
Absolutely. And, you know, it reminds me of the kind of beginning of the movie The Post about the Washington Post, where the editors at The Post figure out that the Times is about to publish something big because one of their investigative journalists hasn't had a byline in months. And so they, you know, they send a copy boy, like, you know, an intern to sneak into the New York Times and try and find out what they're writing about. And they find out it's the Pentagon Papers. So unfortunately, readers won't be able to, you know, pull that same trick because Cardinal reporters have been so good about creating these then and now stories, these follow-ups on work we've done earlier in 2025. So you will find no dearth of bylines by any of our reporters this month. Sorry, guys.
Yeah, and that's something that we do at the end of every year is sort of go back and look at some of the stories we've done and said, well, what happened? What was the outcome here? Are there any updates? And sometimes those are little two-sentence updates, and sometimes they become a whole story. So if you missed those in December, go back and take a look. They're sort of organized. That's a great way to wrap up the year and look at the next. Jeff, as we look ahead to this next year and all the things we're doing at Cardinal, how can readers reach you?
Very easily, jeff@cardinalnews.org, J-E-F-F, not like the name of the Jeff the giraffe, since giraffe
have been in the news.
Yes, it's J-E-F-F at Cardinal News.
Yes. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Great to see you again, and keep up the good work yourself, Lisa.
And thank you for listening to the Cardinal News of Virginia. Thanks to our sponsor, West Piedmont Regional Adult Education, to Sean Eddy of Eddy Alexander for production support, and to Cardinal News' own Zach Shelton. Read all of our paywall-free local news coverage at cardinalnews.org. I'm Lisa Rowan. Take care now.